One of the main criticisms leveled against your movement is that it's anti-Semitic. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu himself has said the founders of the BDS movement want to see the end of the Jewish state.
Well, first, look who's talking. Israel's leaders are nourishing anti-Semitism like never before. They're in bed with the fascists of the world.
I'm Fatima Bhutto, and this is Reframe, where we seek new conversations and perspectives. In this series, we'll be discussing one of the biggest issues of our time, the fate of Palestine and its people, and what the war in Gaza has revealed about the nature of Israel's occupation. My guest this week is one of the most prominent Palestinian human rights defenders, Omar Barghouti. He is the co-founder of BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, a Palestinian movement inspired by the South African anti-apartheid struggle. Successive Israeli governments have tried to delegitimize BDS, subjecting Omar to threats and intimidation. In 2017, Omar received the Gandhi Peace Award for his work. Omar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been on the forefront of the fight to defend human rights in Palestine for decades. Can you tell us what is BDS and what is the philosophy that animates it?
BDS was launched by the absolute majority of Palestinian society in 2005, calling for the basic rights without which Palestinians cannot exercise self-determination. Ending the occupation, ending Israel's regime of racial segregation, which meets the UN definition of apartheid, and the right of refugees to return. By focusing on those three rights, BDS addresses the basic rights stipulated under international law. The most important point about BDS is that it connects the Palestinian liberation struggle with ending complicity internationally, which means we cannot end the occupation and apartheid and have our refugees return and receive reparations without ending the complicity of states, corporations, and institutions. So in a nutshell, the theory of change of the BDS movement is from the grassroots to the grass tops. In order to affect policy change, we need to build people power, which has many, many forms, intersectional coalitions, media power, strategic litigation power, the ability to peacefully disrupt the powers that be, and so on and so forth. And it's most important to say that it is an anti-racist movement that categorically opposes all forms of racism.
But even if we're talking about a movement that connects Palestinians with the rest of the world in this fight to end complicity, is people's power enough to take Israel off its current path?
Well, Israel derives most of its power, as we're seeing during this ongoing genocide, from being armed, funded, and shielded from accountability by the United States, the UK, Germany, the EU, and so on. Yeah. Without those links of complicity, Israel cannot maintain its entire system of oppression. So we think, yes, we can. If we cut those links of complicity, that can help the Palestinian people resist more effectively this system of oppression and eventually dismantle it. We've seen it in South Africa. This is not something completely hypothetical that has never been tested. Peoples across the world have been able to defeat extremely powerful enemies, from India against the British colonialism, Algeria against French colonialism, and South Africa against apartheid. And it took a lot of international solidarity. It wasn't just the internal resistance. External solidarity is also very integral to this resistance.
You have said in the past that the way in which Israel rolls out its own apartheid is far more sophisticated than what happened in South Africa. In what way is it more sophisticated?
Well, it's apartheid 2.0, if you will. It's the newer version. Because Israel has learned a lot from the South African system of apartheid, which in turn learned a lot from the U.S. system of apartheid against indigenous and against black Americans. So Israel knows that, unlike South Africa, it's not an inherently very powerful country that the West needs per se. Of course, it serves imperial powers and so on, but in order for Israel to continue its system of oppression, it has to appear as if it were democratic, liberal. So it cannot afford to have petty apartheid, preventing Palestinian citizens and Jewish citizens from sharing the same hospital wards, although we're getting much closer to that. But apartheid is not about sharing tables or hospital wards. Apartheid is a crime defined in international law as a system of racial domination by one racial group against another that deprives them of basic rights based on their identity and institutionalizes this racial segregation and discrimination. And Israel perfectly fits that paradigm as defined in international law. If you're Jewish Israeli, you're entitled to the entire set of rights. If you're not Jewish, if you're indigenous Palestinian, Christian, Muslim, or otherwise, you're not entitled to the same set of rights. Mm. So Israel is not a state of its citizens. It's a state of the Jewish people worldwide. It doesn't give its citizens who are not Jewish the same rights by law, not just by policy.
Naomi Klein, who's a famous Canadian author and activist, has called BDS a people's foreign policy and says it deserves to be seen as such. I wanted to ask you how Jewish voices are represented in your movement today.
In North America in particular, Jewish support for BDS has always been disproportionately high. During the last few years, it has grown exponentially. And during the genocide, it has grown even further. So everyone has seen those Jewish peaceful disruptions of Congress and Statue of Liberty and the Grand Central Station, extremely inspiring. They understand that there is nothing Jewish about Israel's occupation, settler colonialism, ethnic cleansing, apartheid, or genocide. And therefore, there's nothing anti-Jewish in supporting BDS to dismantle those systems, those structures of oppression, and those crimes. And we are very proud of this Jewish support for BDS, and it helps a lot to counter all the myths about the movement that are trying to silence Palestinian advocacy.
Mm-hmm. It's perhaps not that well known, Omar, that nonviolent resistance in Palestine goes back really a century, and that Palestinian civil society has been active since the time of the British Mandate. Can you speak to us briefly about that history of nonviolence resistance, and also where you place BDS within that story?
Indeed, boycotts in particular go back at least a century in Palestinian history in fighting British colonialism and then Zionist settler colonialism. So boycotts have always been used. We did not learn boycotts from Gandhi or Martin Luther King or from South Africa, as inspiring as those examples have been in the BDS movement, for example. But we've learned it mainly from our own history, from our own roots and heritage of struggle. The most important point to remember is that there's a diversity of resistance forms in Palestine and everywhere else. You don't face colonialism or settler colonialism or any system of oppression with one form of resistance, simply because people are different. There's diversity among people. If you're a student or an artist or a child, I do sometimes workshops in schools in Ramallah or in Nablus, and kids ask me, "We really love this idea of BDS. Can we do it?" I said, "Yes." One parent once told me, "What did you do to our children yesterday in your..." I said, "What happened?" He said, "My daughter formed a checkpoint in the house. When my wife and I came from the supermarket, she checked every item to make sure none of the products were boycottable." And I said, "I'm so proud of your daughter." Yeah.
What are some of the wins that you're most proud of recently?
It's hard to speak about successes in the midst of ongoing genocide, but we must. Mm. We must because it is where we see the hope. Mm. In this unspeakable darkness of ongoing horror, every single day, a new massacre, a new school, a new atrocity. I look at Indonesia or Malaysia or Pakistan or South Africa or Chile or Colombia or the US or the UK, and you see hope everywhere. A movement is growing. Power, grassroots power, is growing like never before. We are successfully challenging powers that be. The Norwegian Sovereign Fund, the absolute largest in the world, recently divested its $500 million worth of Israel bonds. under pressure from the largest trade union in Norway, which is a BDS supporter. But even bigger than that, Intel, the chip maker, cancelled a project of investing $25 billion, with a B, $25 billion near Tel Aviv, 15 miles from Gaza. Basically, they were planning a huge factory. And several factors led to that, including BDS pressure on shareholders. Does it make sense to invest in a war zone where your entire investment may disappear? Isn't this reckless? Isn't this ideological? And indeed, that was much more effective than our ethical and legal arguments in that case. So there are many other cases. Look at what's happening with artists, with academics, with student encampments, trade unions. So all over the place, I think the whole young generation, from Korea to the US, from Sweden to South Africa, they have centered Palestine as part of their identity as a generation that wants a different world. Mm. That is not ruled by extremely horrible corporations and militaristic companies and financial institutions that suck your blood. They want a different world.
But at the same time, as you're having this impact, it's also true that BDS has come under increased scrutiny and attack. And one of the main criticisms leveled against your movement is that it's anti-Semitic. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu himself has said, the founders of the BDS movement want to see the end of the Jewish state. They're classical anti-Semites in modern garb. How do you respond to that?
Well, first, look who's talking. Israel's leaders are nourishing anti-Semitism like never before. They're in bed with the fascists of the world. In Europe, in the US, they're best friends from crazy Christian Zionist zealots in the US. They're anti-Semitic, but they love Israel. This is the new formula. We'll whitewash your anti-Semitism if you love Israel, if you support Israel. So that's one point. The second point is that, as I said earlier, BDS targets Israel's regime of oppression. It does not target an identity as such. What is Jewish about that? I mean, how is that Jewish? Saying it is anti-Semitic. Saying that attacking Israel, attacking Zionism is anti-Semitic, is an anti-Semitic statement, because it equates Israel on the one hand and Zionism with all Jews, as if Jews have no diversity, as if they're a monolith. And finally, if Israel equals all Jews, then this live-streamed genocide we're seeing in Gaza against 2.3 million Palestinians is a Jewish genocide. How more anti-Semitic can it get? Of course it's not. A genocide is an Israeli policy, far-right, fascist government in Israel. It has nothing to do with Jewishness or Judaism.
And what do you say to the other criticism, which is that boycotts, even well-meaning boycotts, will not damage the large corporate owner of a company, but actually will hurt the more vulnerable person who they intend to help, the workers in this case?
Factually, this is false. In our long history of BDS, almost two decades, we've had massive support from trade unions. Is it because they're acting against their class interest? No. They understand that they have some very evil CEOs and board members that want profit above everything else. And in many cases, they help us to boycott their company, to force their company to abandon illegal projects in Israel. It happened with Veolia, the French conglomerate. I personally met with three trade unions of Veolia in Bilbao, and the next day, they plastered all the buses, Veolia buses, boycott Veolia. And then 7 years later, Veolia was forced to abandon Israel after losing over $20 billion worth of contracts. So shareholders start doing this fight against the CEOs and the board after they see the price being paid.
I mean, this brings me to another important point. It's very obvious that Israeli governments feel threatened by BDS. They have campaigned across the West to enact laws officially banning BDS. And in the U.S. today, correct me if I'm wrong here, but 293 anti-BDS bills have been introduced, effective in 38 states. Can you tell us about those laws, and do they widen the net from BDS to other movements?
In fact, in many U.S. state legislatures, anti-BDS legislation has been used to suppress the right of blacks to vote, women's reproductive rights, fossil fuel campaigners, and so on and so forth. It's an absolute template. We've been saying that for many, many years. don't ignore what they're doing against BDS, because they're violating the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the Free Speech Amendment. If they get away with this, who's next? Most progressive movements in the U.S. ignored that. We told them, have you learned anything from McCarthyism? They claim they're going after the communists, but they never stop. It's any dissenting voice. Then most progressives now saw that anti-BDS legislation is only a gateway. It's only a template to be used for other repressions and other suppression of freedoms.
Hmm. And is this something that you can point to in states that started with BDS and then just rolled over other rights?
Just look at Texas.
Texas would be an example.
I mean, Roe versus Wade was reversed years after they passed all these anti-BDS legislation across state legislatures. And it was no coincidence. They built up that it's okay to suspend the freedom of expression on one thing, then you can suspend it on something else if you have the power.
But some places, maybe not states, but certainly some cities like Portland, are now turning that tide back, are they not? They're divesting from companies doing
Absolutely.
Business with Israel. Do you have faith that this will continue to grow?
This is very important, in fact, and we hope this catches on in the UK and elsewhere. Because, as I said earlier, from the grassroots to the grass tops, there's a whole scale in between. You don't jump from influencing student movements and academics and artists and trade unions to affecting Congress in the US, for example. You need to go step by step. So we have to influence cities, more progressive cities, building very large intersectional coalitions, because we've managed to convince the entire progressive movement that the US is so militarized, and it's not just against us, it's against everyone. Look what's happening with health services, education, jobs, and so on. So all those cities that passed anti-military investment laws and policies were due to very large coalitions pushing, not just the Palestine advocacy movement. So the fossil fuel, the climate justice movement, LGBT movement, Jewish progressives, and many, many others.
I want to turn to you for a moment. You've faced ongoing intimidation by successive Israeli governments. They've attempted to revoke your Israeli residency. You faced delays in the renewal of your travel documents, and you've been called personally a threat to the state of Israel. How does this impact you?
I feel very awkward talking about this in the midst of genocide, honestly, because it pales.
But it's still trying to silence a voice that is important in this time, isn't it?
It is. Clearly, they're not succeeding.
No.
So, I mean, I'm louder than ever. So it's not working.
Okay.
Yes, they've tried everything. I mean, the whole point, they tried to get to you to make you feel that, you know what, I'm giving up. It's not worth it. I want to live my life. You know, I will do things for Palestine, but, you know, I can't do this anymore. That's what they try. But clearly that's not working with me, because my response to every phase of intimidation is do more. You will never succeed to deter me. I will not stop until the system of oppression is dismantled entirely.
Omar, we're going to turn to the audience now.
Yes, my name is Jonathan Rosenhead. I'm one of the Jews who supports BDS as a movement for liberation. Can we build on the public outrage at Israel's brutal assault in Gaza to turbocharge the BDS and sanctions movement? And if so, how do we build on this outrage?
Thanks, Jonathan. The most important thing is to recognize that it is happening. Can we accelerate it, I guess, is the question. Absolutely. I think the student movement, those encampments, and this boldness and courage in fighting the system, the complicit universities and their investments, put the B and the D in BDS on the map much more than before. So today, from pension funds to even states, are taking what we are calling for much more seriously. Just in November of 2024, we've seen more than 52 states endorse a military embargo of Israel. In 2023, that would have been impossible to even imagine, that we will get dozens of states supporting the military embargo. So it is happening. But because the genocide is so horrific and it's live streamed, it's very easy to despair that we're not moving fast enough. Of course, we're not moving fast enough, but that's as fast as we can do in order to build a sustainable movement. Change is happening. It's happening everywhere, but it will take more time, indeed.
Next question. We've got a gentleman over there.
How far do you think the Western states are going to go in dismantling their own sort of ostensibly liberal democratic systems in the West in order to protect Israel and to protect the genocide? And what can we do to stand against that and to sort of resist it?
Suppression of free speech on Palestine, repression of peaceful demonstrations and peaceful protests and peaceful disruptions will not stop with Palestine. I think in the UK, more and more groups are realizing this. For example, when the former government tried to pass, the Conservatives tried to pass an anti-BDS legislation that was so draconian, so McCarthyite, so repressive, the Palestine Solidarity Campaign managed to form a very large, very broad coalition for the first time ever to address this, because everyone from Amnesty to every other civil rights groups recognized that unless we stop this, they're coming for us. But the main point is this, what you said, which is those powers that be, those Western elites, those colonial states are really dismantling liberal democracy as we know it to defend their favorite settler colony, Israel. And this should scare every liberal, not just every progressive or leftist. Every liberal should really be worried. Your civic rights that you take for granted are disappearing before your eyes. You can stop it before it goes away.
We've got a question in the front.
What are the benefits that you see for building international solidarity, linking the Palestinian solidarity movement, for example, with other global solidarity campaigns, global struggles against colonialism and extractivism more generally?
Thank you.
Thanks for this. A very recent example, just October 2024, there was a week of action against Chevron, the giant oil company, oil and gas company in the US, because it is very complicit in extracting Israeli claimed gas in the Mediterranean. So it's a very important asset for powering Israel's genocide and apartheid regime, so to speak. But it's also destroying indigenous lands in Ecuador. So we connected the struggles very well, and climate justice activists did an incredible job in supporting this campaign. It is very important that every sector organizes in their sector. So academics and students and unions in universities can do a lot of work in universities. But what are filmmakers and writers and feminists and LGBT activists and climate, you know, there's so many groups that we work with, and everyone can be active in their own sector. So all those powers coming together, if you have a common strategy, as we do, the BDS movement has one global common strategy with very different tactics that are context sensitive everywhere.
Omar, I just want to end with one last question. You've said that BDS doesn't follow a linear path to progress, and that we lose some battles, but we win most. So the general direction is going up. With a new US president, does this still hold true?
I think when fascism loses its masks, it might prompt better progressive action. We've seen in the first Trump administration, those 4 years, how Black Lives Matter went onto the world stage to become a movement that has inspired tens and hundreds of millions worldwide. That was during the Trump era. I think fascists with masks can be very dangerous because they commit the crime while maintaining this liberal facade, like the Labour government in this country. I mean, the austerity and so on. Of course, it's better than the Conservatives, but that doesn't say much. So we have to aim for more. But I think, yes, when far-right parties lose their mask and go on this massive repression against everyone, that prompts everyone who is sitting on their bottom and not doing enough to get up and start moving. And I think that gives us hope that we will see, especially given the ongoing genocide, we will see new energies from everywhere that have been fence-sitting for so long, getting off their neutral position and doing something, for not just for Palestinians, for the sake of humanity.
Thank you, Omar Barghouti, for speaking with us today. And thank you to all of you who've joined us in the audience this evening.